How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible.
Oh, my mama. Oh, my mama made it, man. Anything's possible.
Rainy days, jump shot fade away. This the best Celtics podcast day to day, especially when the season get hectic. I stay waiting on it like receiving a Nets pick. Nothing like the terrible analysts on the TV. So in depth, you might even hear a story on Gigi. So in depth, they might do an hour about the D-League. So in depth, you probably should pay them, but it's a freebie. Yeah, John Corrales and Jay King, locked on trying to get the 18th ring. So you can miss me with the blah blah. No more Geno time, we watching Jay do the Zaza. Melis.
Hello and welcome back to the Locked On Celtics podcast with the Rain and Jays. Today it's me, your boy Jay King from MassLive.com. I am joined by a wonderful, wonderful guest, Chris Forsberg of ESPN. Chris, we appreciate you coming on, my man. We are going to talk about Game 3. We actually had an off-season planning type podcast, fully recorded, ready to go, but you know what? It's way too early to talk about the postseason. We're postponing that. We're talking about Game 3. Game 3 was just a ridiculous comeback. So I got Chris on here with me. Chris, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming on.
What's up? And move aside, Danger Cart. Your off-season is going to have to wait.
Yeah, sorry, Danger Cart. So we record the podcast with Ryan Bernardoni, a.k.a. at Danger Cart. That will be sometime later this week on a day off. But
my favorite part is that for those who want a little insight is me and Jay are sitting there getting dinner before game three last night. And Jay is 1,000% onto the offseason. He is 1,000% convinced that the Celtics are going to get steamrolled yet again in game three. And at that point, I should have known that we would get a magical game in which Marcus Smart would turn into Steph Curry and Jonas Jerebko would finally get a chance to be his old awesome self and the Celtics would win.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was only rational to believe that they were going to win. And even if they competed better, even if a lot of things went right for them, the Cavs had just been playing on another planet. You know, they wiped away the Raptors who had loaded up to try to compete with them. They trampled Celtics in game one and two. And so, yeah, I arrived in Cleveland fully expecting to see two Celtics losses. I didn't expect to see them roll over like they did in games one and two, but I definitely didn't expect like the Marcus Smart show with with one ridiculous three after another. Some of those threes were just absolutely bonkers. Like there was one he pulled up like 30 feet with 18 on the shot clock. There was another like crossover pull up in the guy's mug with like 17 on the shot clock. Just an outrageous Marcus Smart performance.
Has there been another player you can think of, at least on the Celtics in recent history, that has had as much irrational confidence? Like, is there another player that when he gets the ball above the break, you sit there and it's almost instinctive now. We do it on press rows, and they're like, no, 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 yes. And he, like, it's astounding to me. Like, he's shooting 41% beyond the three-point arc this postseason. It makes no sense. It's like you got to this stage, and Marcus was like, all right, I'm just going to be Steph Curry for a little while.
He's just going to let it flow and let it show, man. that was the greatest quote. Like, let it flow and let it show. Definitely my life motto from now on. But yeah, he's like one of those guys. The variance of what he brings is just incredible. Like game one against Washington, he asked to come out of the game because he was so bad. And then game seven against Washington, you know, he makes all sorts of winning plays, helps them prevail. And that's just kind of Marcus Smart. 27 points, 7 assists, and 5 rebounds is not Marcus Smart. 7 out of 10 from the arc is not Marcus Smart. But it's kind of like what I think Danger Car, we'll bring him up again, even though we shoved aside his podcast for a couple of days. He said on Twitter, like, Marcus Smart is the king of lost causes. And it's kind of true. Like, whenever there seems like there's not much to play for, and whether the Celtics are down like 25 or whatever, Marcus Smart just kind of has a habit of reaching another place and refusing to give in to the expectation that the Celtics are going to fold. And that's what happened last night.
You even think about game one where they were getting trampled, and then Marcus goes out there in what, like the third quarter, starts trying to defend Tristan Thompson and gives all sorts of energy on the glass. You know, ends up fouling out with like 9 minutes to go, but that little stretch from like the third into the fourth quarter was probably the most the best the Celtics that they had played that night, and maybe through the first two games. You know, and Marcus was mad. He was legitimately upset the next day at practice. He was like, "Why? I don't understand why we're not playing harder. You know, we shouldn't just be happy to be here. We got to come out." And now they got smothered in game two as well. But, you know, it's funny to me that Isaiah goes down and Brad says, well, it's not on one guy to step up and replace his scoring load. And Marcus goes, hold my beer, and goes out there and literally channels IT for a night. And then today he's sitting there saying, you know, during their little FaceTime call with Isaiah after the win, he legitimately goes up and he's like, I channeled my inner IT.
Yeah. too funny, man. Like, Marcus Smart, I still can't believe he did that, but he's just kind of like that. Every once in a while he can just dig deep and do stuff you didn't expect from him. And one thing about the win, which was kind of stunning to me, was how many good three-point shots, and obviously 10 three-point shots from Marcus Smart, and a lot of them were really tough. Those aren't good shots, but they had 40 three-point attempts as a team. They hit 18 of 40 three-point attempts, and that's without Isaiah Thomas to bend the defense and create open looks. So it was weird to see how easily the Celtics still manufactured pretty good looks without Isaiah Thomas on the court. The Cavaliers' defense hasn't been great in this series, and obviously the Celtics didn't score a lot in games one or two. I thought they missed a lot of shots early in those games and kind of fell apart. But they got a lot of good looks even without Isaiah in game three, and then obviously they needed Marcus Smart to go bonkers.
So what I'm taking away from that statement is you're saying that the Celtics are a better team without Isaiah Thomas.
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is,
it kind of sounded like you were saying that.
No. Let's rewind here. Isaiah Thomas is a second team All-NBA player who deserved to be second team All-NBA. Isaiah Thomas is one of the best offensive players in the NBA. Isaiah Thomas, yes, he's a defensive liability, but like, he's well worth his defensive shortcomings because he is so damn good with the basketball in his hands, or even off ball at breaking down defenses. And the Celtics wouldn't have sniffed the Eastern Conference Finals without him. They wouldn't have sniffed 53 wins, the number one seed, any of that without Isaiah Thomas. So it's crazy to me that people, after one game where LeBron James was garbage, like, it was probably the worst LeBron James has been in years.
2008, when he checked out against the Celtics in that year?
Yeah, like he never checked out that year. That was the year he had 45 in game seven, wasn't it? Like
That's 2012.
Yeah, like, no, he had 45 against Pierce in that duel, remember? That was when Isaiah watched.
Oh, then it was 2008. What was the year that he just totally, like,
2010 or 11, and he still had, like, 27, 10, and 9, or whatever, or 27, 18, and 9, or something ridiculous in the game where people said he didn't bring it. But, he hasn't been that bad in years. Marcus Smart has never been that good. Like, a lot of funky stuff went right for the Celtics to have a chance to win that game. And granted,
and
a lot
happens.
of
this is what happens, like, right? Like, a star player goes down, and you typically have one game where things are just weird, and you can't explain it, and, like, people make these crazy arguments like, oh, maybe they're better without Isaiah. But I think we'll see in the games upcoming that things will resolve a little bit, and the Celtics will struggle offensively, and the Cavaliers will take advantage of that, and LeBron will go back to being superhuman. But it is funny for one day. People get really rattled when things go off the rails. Like they can't just say, like, oh, it was a weird night. We have to come up with an excuse, and we just sort of default to, oh, it must be because the superstar player isn't naturally a superstar, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't get, and it's only because he's 5'9" that people start to say they should trade him, yada yada yada. And I know he's gonna have a big contract raise in a year or so. I know LeBron James and the Cavaliers and Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, and the Golden State Warriors are still out there as these superpowers that are going to be really difficult to compete with over the next few years. I realize that, but you don't just trade away a second-team All-NBA player who's 28 years old. And I'm concerned about the hip injury for him. Obviously, it might require surgery. It will almost surely require a pretty lengthy rehab, I would assume. But as long as he's healthy and can return healthy and can return to being the Isaiah Thomas who kind of swept through the NBA world this year and surprised everyone, like, this is a guy who he's an offense unto himself. Whenever he's on the court, the Celtics score and score and score, and it doesn't really matter who's alongside him. I just don't get the people who think that the Celtics should trade him. It's like they've spent years mining for a true star talent, and they finally got one, and people are like, yeah, trade him.
And trade him in the final year of a contract when he would have, like, little to no value on the open market, and you would get pennies on the dollar in return for trying. I don't know. I agree. It's just preposterous. And hey, we know how it works. People say crazy things I don't necessarily think to get ratings, but it does promote conversation, and I understand why people do it. I don't get overly worked up about it, and I think Isaiah knows by now not to get too crazy about it. But I do look forward to that time when, in a couple weeks or wherever it is, that we get to finally talk to Isaiah, and he'll have some fun reaction to it, and he'll needle those people that had those opinions. I think the biggest bummer to me with Isaiah's injury, besides the fact that he's not here for the East Finals, and it doesn't seem fair because of how much he kind of went through, and he should really have this opportunity to play on this big stage. And, you know, I think about just 2 years ago, getting swept by the Cavaliers. That was such motivation for him to show that he could be a winner on this stage and compete with the best teams. I just feel bad that, you know, the first two games weren't really, or the first six quarters weren't a reflection of the progress he's made this year. And I think we know that hip injury has played into it, but I'm also bummed because I think it's going to take away, regardless of the path they go here, whether it's surgery or rehab, it would seemingly take away a part of his summer. And I think back to last year and, you know, all those Book of Isaiah videos he posted and how hard he worked, you know, that was a big reason why he was able to make a sizable leap forward this year. I mean, adding Horford as well is obviously part of that process, but you know, I wonder how much he's going to be able to really kind of work this summer and how that will affect him getting ready for training camp and all that. But I guess if there's one dude who you don't have to worry about kind of finding a way to get back to his old self, I think Isaiah will be supremely motivated to get back out there and get back to what we saw this season.
Yeah. And to be clear, like, the Celtics are definitely a better defensive team when he is off the court. Like, there's no doubt there's a defensive drop off when he's on the court, but it's just so worth it because he's so good offensively. And I do think the Celtics need to find a way to return to the defensive prowess they showed last year. They had a legitimate drop off this year. And last year, like, they had a top five defense with Isaiah Thomas. It's not like you can't do it. It's not like they're incapable of doing it. It's just, they have to find more rebounding. They have to get bigger, I think, in some other areas, and I mean, I just don't understand these people. I just don't get these people at all. Let's get back to game three, though. One thing that I thoroughly enjoyed, I don't know if you saw this, but on the second to last play, Marcus Smart, it was the one where Avery Bradley ended up finding Jarebko in the corner. Marcus Smart set like the most obscene moving screen I've ever seen. He just like sprinted into a screen and kind of never stopped. It was just like full clear out, it looked
like a blocking sled. You know, like someone who hits one of those football blocking sleds and just drives it for five. Like, you know, he just went right into him. Did you see the last 2 minute report too? Called it illegal.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
right?
That was unreal. And then Jarebko was another big part. Jarebko, why do you understand why Stevens hasn't played Jarebko for most of the playoffs, and especially in this series when his switching and his length is valuable and his shooting?
I mean, I think we're both kind of baffled, right? Like, it became obvious at the start of that Chicago series that Amir just, for whatever reason, just didn't work in that series, and they needed to get some more athleticism on the court and spread things out a little bit and get smaller, get the Lopez away from the basket and whatever they had to do. And we all sat there, and I think we all agreed that night that it was going to be Jarebko was going into the starting lineup, or, you know, something where, you know, because he had started in the past, it just made a lot of sense. And when Brad threw Gerald Green at us, we're all like, is he joking? Are you serious right now? And now it worked. And I still don't understand how it worked. And good on Gerald for being ready. I mean, he really did come in and at a time when they needed a little bit of a scoring punch, gave it to him. I mean, same thing as with Isaiah. You know, there are clear defensive limitations with Joe Green out there. And when you have Gerald and Isaiah during those third parts of those series, it was certainly difficult. But, you know, hey, he did his job. They won, what, four in a row, got to five in a row, really, with the Wizards series. And, you know, and then when Brad audible again, I think we all sat there and said, all right, well, maybe this is the time for Jarebko. Nope, right back to Amir. And I don't know. I kept thinking, like, did Jonas do something? Does Brad hate Scandinavia? Is there some reason that he's not getting a chance? And again, good on Jarebko because, you know, he's a pretty touchy dude. He could get pretty angry in a heartbeat. And so if he reacted negatively to this and just checked out and was like, you know what, they're not going to play me, screw it, I'm just not into it, and whatever, go through the motions. But no, Brad throws him in there and at the early in the third quarter, and he totally changes the game. You know, they don't win that game if Jarebko doesn't go nuts and provide energy and hit the glass. You know, what did he have, 5 rebounds in 12 minutes or something like that? I think there was, like, as many rebounds as the next highest guy on the team. So, you know, good on Jarebko for coming in and giving that energy. He's standing over who did he knock?
Kevin Love.
Kevin Love, yeah. He's like, quit flopping. You know, it's like, I love that little swagger about him. He's perfect for this series. I do think that's why if Amir can't go, or even if they just use Amir's shoulder as an excuse to make another tweak with the lineup, that we'll see Jarebko start tomorrow night. It's just so funny that we all expected to get here. It's just such a long and winding road to get here. And but hey, we're finally getting in. And shouts to Brian Robb for finally being able to celebrate starting the Swede and getting to see Jonas really emerge in this series.
Yeah, yeah. So Brian Robb of Celtics Hub and 98.5 The Sports Hub and basically everywhere else. he said back in December the Celtics should consider starting Jarebko. He has been on the play Jarebko bandwagon stronger than anyone. He has been beating that drum for a long time. And I do think it's kind of been like everybody who's kind of watched the Celtics for the last couple of years, it was Jarebko would play a role in the regular season, and then it would increase in the playoffs when his switching, when his three-point shooting became kind of more important and more helpful. And this year, that kind of never happened until game three, the second half. And the Celtics were plus 18 in his 12 minutes and 32 seconds. They outscored the Cavs by 76.1 points per 100 possessions with Jarebko on the court. Like, it was just absurd. And I do think the Celtics kind of needed his attitude. Like, he's a prickly guy. And
I love how we had to search for the right adjectives to describe him, because he's like a super nice dude, but it doesn't take much to give people contact. Back, remember when the Winter Storm Jonas, like, and so we just kind of like jokingly asked him about it, and then he got real snippy about it, like, oh, that's the only reason you want to talk to me. It's like little things set him off, but that's great on a basketball court. That's perfect.
Yeah, so he's got a little bit of a competitive edge to him. And the Celtics needed that, because the Cavaliers were rolling over them. And they kind of needed to stand up and fight back. And the 20 or 48 hours that they experienced, where first they lose by 44 points in the biggest drubbing I've ever seen in an NBA basketball game. And it was in the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, I've never seen a game go so poorly for one club. And then they lose Isaiah Thomas on top of that for the rest of the postseason. It, like, that could have crushed their psyche. I think it says a lot about them. Like Avery Bradley said after game two, it's going to say a lot about who we are as men, how we play in game three. Like that is a weighty, weighty comment. And they stood up. And even when Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving were going nuts in the first half, I thought the Celtics just stayed solid, and they didn't overreact to it. They didn't get broken by it. I thought that was the most impressive part. Obviously, you have the comeback with Marcus Smart, and you have the game winner with Avery Bradley, and you have Jarebko coming off the bench to play these great minutes, and you have huge shots by Kelly Olynyk and Al Horford. But to me, the most telling part of the effort wasn't that they won. It was that they refused to let that first half, when the Cavs were hitting just ridiculous shot, like just throwing up, not garbage because they're great individual players who are making great shots, but like Kevin Love with the jab step in someone's mug from the corner, Kyrie Irving like crossing over and pulling up for threes. These shots were super tough, and the Celtics didn't let it break them. And,
yeah,
and they just kind of stuck with it the whole time.
I think we said the same thing, right? It was like the end of the first quarter, and they were down 11. It was like, wow, that was probably the best quarter they played all series. And it felt, you know, it felt ridiculous to say that because the Cavs couldn't miss, but it just felt that way. And, you know, it's sort of, I mean, not to fall into Brad Stevens' cliches, but, you know, you felt good about the shots the Celtics were getting and the shots they were forcing the Cavaliers to take. I think Stats and Info had a number for us that the Cavs shot something like 5 of 10 against Marcus Smart from three-point land in the first half of that game. And, like, that's absurd when you consider the way Marcus Smart plays defense. And now in the second half, they were 0 for 4 against them. And it's sort of – now, some of that was just they couldn't keep hitting all those shots. But, you know, it also speaks to the way the Celtics sort of kicked it up and took it to another level. But, yeah, like, I try to think about all the teams in the league that would have kept fighting at that point. And it's just hard for me to imagine that losing by 44, losing your best player, falling behind by 21, that most teams wouldn't be like, you know what, vacation time. Let's just kick it down, throw Jordan Mickey in there, and we'll see you in October.
Yeah, and even more than just being down 21 points and everything that had gone before, they were 16.5-point underdogs. Like, this was, from the start, just a ridiculous proposition for them to try to win. And then on top of it, they got down 21 points in the third quarter. And it was just a stunning, stunning comeback. And it does speak to their unwillingness to fold. And obviously, you would prefer not to lose by 44 in game two. And I don't think they competed at their top to their highest, to their standard in game one and two. But game three, with everything that had gone wrong, they just really stood strong. It was a weird LeBron James game. It was, from the start, just a bizarre LeBron James game. Like, Jay Crowder just ripped the ball out of his hands underneath the hoop. LeBron was like throwing strange turnovers. He didn't really do too much, and part of that was just that Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving were on another level for the first half. But I haven't seen that LeBron James in years. I thought he had risen past that, and like Brad Stevens said, it's not wise to criticize the world's best basketball player. Like, he is the world's best basketball player. He is still the world's best basketball player after that outing. But it was just weird. And then he snapped on a reporter after the game. He was apparently going at it with a fan in Cleveland. Just a weird, weird LeBron situation and game. I don't know what to make of it.
Well, you got to tell everybody your conspiracy theory that he did it on purpose, right?
To be clear, I don't really believe that he did it.
All right, I'll own it then. I think LeBron James recognized that things have come a little bit too easy in this postseason, and thinking a little bit ahead, he looked at the Western Conference and he said, "Wow, you know, last year was really tough against those guys, and now they got Kevin Durant, and I need somehow to teach my guys that we're at some point we're going to hit a little bit of adversity. It's not just going to be a smooth sail, and how will they respond?" And so I think there is some part of him that said, "You know what? I'm just going to see what they can do. I'm going to take this night off. I'm going to get a little wild. I'm going to start screaming at fans. I'm going to throw the ball six rows deep and just see if these other guys can step up." And they didn't. And so I fully expect to get engaged, take over LeBron in game four. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Cavs bounce back really quickly. But I do think there's something to the notion that, you know, he just needed to teach these guys that, listen, we got to be better if we're going to defend this title. And like, there's a danger in that, because you never want to like snub the Celtics or give them any motivation. And but that being said, I do think just subconsciously there was something had to have happened, because there's no way that the best basketball player on the planet can have a half like that.
Yeah, Marcus Smart had 19 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists in the second half. And LeBron James had 3 points, 1 rebound, 1 assist, and 3 turnovers. just a wild, wild half. And I think it's probably giving him too much credit to say that he was just testing his team. Like if he was just testing his team, like, it just seems weird to me, because – The Cavaliers still only lost after Marcus Smart reached another planet and Avery Bradley's three-pointer hit the rim and the backboard and then the rim and then somehow.
Well, maybe he didn't count on that part. Maybe he was like, you know, at some point we'll pull it together and we'll get this game. And then things got weird. You know, again, like the Brad draws up a bunch of not crazy ATOs, but a bunch of effective ATOs. Guys make shots. I don't know if LeBron could have schemed out everything. You can't factor in a ball bouncing around for 2 seconds and then falling through with 0.1 on the clock and all that. I'm not saying it's like a huge conspiracy theory, and I wouldn't be just shocked if it was just a bad game. But that being said, I just need to justify how LeBron could possibly have that kind of a game, and that's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah, and he didn't even take a shot in the final quarter. Like, it was just, especially after the way he had put his, just commanded the first two games. Like, he owned game one. He dominated game two. And then game three, he was just totally out of sorts from the beginning. Just really stunning. He hasn't had a bad game in the playoffs in God knows how long. Like 2014. When's the last time he had a bad game in the playoffs? You know, like,
well, we just said it, in that game that we always reference as checking out, his stat line was something that if a Celtics player did it now, we'd be writing for 3 days about.
Yeah, and he's so damn good. So it was really stunning to see him like that. What are the other takeaways?
Can I tell you my favorite part of the game that we haven't talked about yet?
I'm excited to hear this.
The Al Horford interview.
Oh, that was the best.
We got Hart. People counting us out. Like Al, who we've seen maybe three glimpses of crazy emotion from this season. Like there's an occasional raise the roof. There's an occasional like mini flex after a layup. But then CSN and Abby Chan get him right after the game. And he is as worked up as I've ever seen him. Like, I didn't know Al Horford had that emotional level in him. And the best part of it is he's screaming, like looking into the camera as if he's cutting a wrestling promo, going, "Nobody believes in us. They thought we were dead." And then, like, halfway through the interview, it's like he started coming back to earth a little bit. And he was, and the back half of the interview is completely out. He's just like, "Yeah, you know, we got to go out. We got to play hard. We got to play good." But that first part, that one part where you knew the blood was still flowing was just cool to see. And that's neat because we always hear these guys say like, "Oh, Al's a leader. He steps up and you know, he's the one who talks to us in the locker room." And I think there are times, at least for me, I sit there and go, "Really?" Like, we see him sitting there eating his applesauce before the game and watching video, and I'm like, when does he give these speeches, or when is he really being a vocal leader? And not that I ever questioned that he did it. I just didn't think it was maybe as emphatic as sometimes we hear people make it out to be. And so that was the first time that I was like, oh, wow, I can see him in those first few minutes after a game walking into the locker room and being that fired up. And not getting in guys' faces, but just being like, "Hey, you know, this is great. This is what we got to do." Like, and players, because the same way we reacted to how unique it was, they probably react the same way. And it's like, "Whoa, Al's up on 11 right now. We better listen to what he's saying."
Yeah, and I think that win meant a great amount to him because of how easily he has been dispatched by LeBron James in the past three playoffs. He had lost 14 straight games to LeBron James's team in the playoffs. He had been swept out of the playoffs three straight years by LeBron. And he left Atlanta, I think, at least partially because he wanted it to be different. He wanted to go to a place where maybe not this year, but maybe one day he can compete with LeBron and compete with the Cavaliers and finally have a chance to get to the NBA Finals and compete for a championship. And so I think it meant so much for him, not just the fact that the Celtics were knocked to the mat and been getting trounced for the first two games and then lost Isaiah Thomas and then had this awesome effort in game three, but there must have just been this sense of relief that, okay, maybe the Cavaliers aren't totally invincible. And if we can get one game, then we can get another at some future point in time. And so I think it must have felt like just an unreal moment for him as a competitor to literally just get smacked by LeBron for three years and then two games in this playoff series to finally get one against LeBron. And it speaks to how good LeBron James is, how great the Cavaliers have been, that Horford has played for some great teams and has just never, ever been able to compete, never been able to steal a win against LeBron. And finally he got one. So
yeah, and that's all we've ever heard about Al, right, is like the only thing that matters to him is winning, whether it was in college at Florida and then, you know, getting to the playoffs every year. But you can tell, like, all he wants to do is sort of get over that hump. And he, just like you said, you think about, what was it, 2 years ago when the Hawks were 60 wins and the number one seed and they still got steamrolled. And, you know, it really must have felt good for him. There was a guy actually, like, third row behind one of the baskets near the Celtics bench that had a sign that said, "LeBron James, 14-0, Al Horford." And I don't know if Al gets really too worked up about that. But, you know, when the fans are sitting there reminding you about it, I'm sure there's something in the back of his mind like, "Man, I came here to get over this hump." Same deal. Like, maybe there's a little bit of him now that goes, okay, this is possible, that the Celtics there's still so much room for them to grow, and that eventually the Cavs will have to come back to earth a little bit. And maybe he just recognizes in that moment that there's going to be a window for him to get past this and get over that hump. And it must have really been – again, there's no other explanation for him just going all out emotional Al, which was very cool to see.
It was so funny. It looked like he wanted to fight the camera. Like he was so fired up. It was like KG just jumped into his body for like 20 seconds. It was fascinating. It was one of the best interviews I've seen this season from the Celtics, just because he got nuts. That was like his KG bar fight moment. He would never say anything like the bar fight thing, but it was right after the game, and he was just still wrapped up in all the excitement. You and I, we were both wrapped up in the excitement of game three. We didn't expect to see a good game. We didn't expect certainly to see a Celtics win, but it happened, man. It all happened. That was real life.
So what happens with game four?
So I think the Celtics compete again, but what it is the Cavaliers just have such a different margin of error, especially now that Isaiah is gone. It's really tough for the Celtics. Like you look at game three, the Celtics only had 9 turnovers. They hit 18 three-pointers. Marcus Smart went he played better than he's ever played. He was incredible offensively, which you don't always expect. They got huge minutes from Jarebko. They played great defensively. And so many things had to go right for them to win by 3 points with 0.1 seconds left. So, maybe I think they compete again. I think they'll defend. I don't think they'll get swept away like they did in games 1 and 2, but I fear that was their only win of the series, and that they'll probably lose the next two after the Cavaliers regroup and LeBron returns to being the best player in the world.
But that's okay, right? Because I think after games 1 and 2, I mean, 10 minutes into or 20 minutes into game 3, if someone told you they were just going to find a way to steal one, and it was going to be like a really, really satisfying win, in which, one of your youngest players and one of the potential building blocks for your franchise is going to step up, I think people, Celtics fans would have taken that in a heartbeat. And, you never want to just dismiss it. I always walk this line because we know, Brad Stevens genuinely believes that his team can come back in this series. And I bet his players do, too. Even, there's some – I'm sure everyone has a little bit of doubt knowing how good the Cavaliers are. But that being said, I hate to just dismiss their chances, even when we were talking about it coming into the series. I think we know, again, there's still a gap there. But I think just if that win is the only thing the Celtics get out of this series, that's still a real positive for this team to win on the road, to win the way they did with the guys that stepped up, with Avery stepping up, win the final play. I just think that's good for the future. In a year where, let's face it, it was going to be tough for anyone to push Golden State or Cleveland, and for the Celtics to at least they got one more win than the rest of the East did against the Cleveland. So that's good for something so far.
Yeah, I think, at this stage, they're in the Eastern Conference Finals or the number one seed. It's weird to say that was a moral victory, but considering how the first two games went and considering how Cleveland rushed through the rest of the Eastern Conference, I do think it means something to win a game, and I think it means something to right themselves after those first two games, so that if they had gone out and gotten cracked again, then it would have been really tough for them to swallow. I think now, at least they know they gave it a shot. And really, this series is about finding out how big the gap is, right? Because the Celtics have decisions to make, whether it's with the number one overall pick, whether it's trying to trade other pieces. They need to know how much of a gap there is between them and Cleveland, so that they can see, what do we need to do with our future decisions? What path do we need to go? How much better do we need to get to compete with these guys? And look, if obviously games 1 and 2 were disasters, but if you can compete for the rest of the series, then LeBron won't always stay as good as he is. The Cavaliers have an aging roster. I don't think they'll always be as good as they are right now. I don't think even next year maybe they'll be as good as they are right now. They don't have much flexibility either. So, like, if you can stay somewhat close, maybe, and I don't think it'll have too much of an impact on what Danny Ainge does. I think they'll most likely keep the number one pick. But
is that your preferred path, though? Not to stomp on Deja Card's episode, but what is your preferred path right now? What would you do?
Yeah, I would keep the number one pick. I would take Markelle Fultz. I think he is a stud. I think he's a probable longtime all-star. I think he can play with Isaiah Thomas because Isaiah Thomas can go off ball and because Fultz is a 40-plus percent three-point shooter. I think – and he's 6'4 with a 6'10 wingspan. Like, he can guard bigger guys. So I think when you can lock in a guy who could be that top five or top 10 player in the league one day. Now, he's not going to do it right away. He's not going to do it his first couple of years, but he's got that type of potential. And when you can lock that guy into a rookie contract and have him basically under team control for 9 years, because once he's a restricted free agent, you can match anything. Then I think you have to do that. And unless like some otherworldly option comes along,
then, it's not going to happen, though. I just can't imagine. When we heard all the price tags at the trade deadline, you know, what makes you think anything's going to change before the draft? Like, teams with stars, what we've seen the last few years is that the prices are just ridiculous. It's really hard for teams to be willing to move them, unless they got the situation like the Kings, where they just had to move on from DeMarcus. But I just don't see it happening. I agree. Like, to me, this is easy. You go get Markelle. Cross your fingers and hope you can make the pitch to Gordon Hayward and get him here. And if you strike out there, you know, you examine what your backup plans are there. And maybe you roll the dice with Blake's injury history or anyone you can convince to come in. But if you tell me that the team that won last night, if you add a healthy Isaiah Thomas, Markelle Fultz, and a premier free agent, like, all right, I think even if there is a gap, it's closed a little bit. And I'd be really interested to see by the end of next season, by the end of two seasons from now, what the gap looks like and where your team is versus where the Cavs are. I just think that's just so much better of a way to set up a sustainable contender.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how the Celtics will look with another really good playmaker alongside Isaiah Thomas. Like, the amount of attention teams send at Isaiah Thomas is incredible at times. Like, Washington was literally just leaving people wide open across the court to focus on what Isaiah Thomas was doing. And if you can get like Gordon Hayward or Markelle Fultz, if he's as good as advertised in that situation with guys closing out, it could be super dangerous. Isaiah Thomas is a guy who requires so much attention all the time. All right. We got to get to Barrio. We got to get some tacos, man.
Yeah, man. I'm upset. The best part of this is what the part that people can't see is like we're just like three doors down from each other in a hotel room, and then we're on two different cell phones. And then when we finish this, we're just gonna walk out our doors and be like, "Hey man, what's up? You wanna go get some tacos?"
Yeah, but before I let you go, I do wanna give you the story that I teased before we got.
Yes. Oh my God, I can't believe I forgot all the way to this point.
So I was on the radio, and I thought it was Doug Christie's show, and I was like pumped up because I was a big Doug Christie guy. Like I loved the way Doug Christie played when he was on the Kings. I was a big fan of those Kings teams with Chris Webber, Peja Stojakovic. Like Doug Christie was my guy. Like he was my boy back then. Like I really appreciate his game. So I get on the show and I'm like pumped up to go on the show, and I get on, and his co-host says, "Here we are with Jeff King." I'm like, damn, Jeff. And so I didn't say anything the first time because I was like, okay, he's just introducing me. I don't have to say anything. It'll just be one time, whatever. Every time he asked a question, he said, "Jeff." And it got to a point where, like, once he said it once and I didn't correct him, I didn't want to correct him the second time because I didn't correct him the first time. So he probably said Jeff King like 10 times. And yeah, so Doug Christie, I was pumped to go on a show, but he thinks my name is Jeff.
I can feel for you in this situation, because not only do people what's funny is I got called Jeff on a radio show last week, and I did the same thing. I didn't bring it up. I just kept going, and the host actually figured it out, and he came back, and he was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I don't know why I had that name in my mind, but Chris, you're here with us," and you know, he soldiered on. But there have been like multiple instances where people have called me Peter, for Peter Forsberg, and they'll do it throughout the whole show. And same deal, like, I don't know what the proper way to play that off is. Like, sometimes you don't want to be the jerk who they're bringing on their show and correcting them. But sometimes I do want to just be like, yeah, man, I hope you get to talk to Peter someday, but my name is Chris. And move on from it. But hang in there, Jeff. You'll be all right.
Yeah, Jeff, man. Jeff King, classic. All right, we left you with, you know, my new name, Jeff King.
You got to change your Twitter handle.
Yeah, by Jeff King. All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming out. We got to go get some tacos. Everybody else, Locked On Celtics Podcast. If you're not a subscriber already, search for Locked On Celtics Podcast, Audio Boom, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, whatever else, wherever you listen to podcasts, we are there. Give us a 5-star rating. Subscribe to us. Listen to us. We are here every Monday through Friday. We're here for you. We'll be here through the draft. We'll be here through Summer League. We are the greatest Celtics podcast, the only Monday through Friday Celtics podcast. We just give you the good. So come back, listen to us, and that's it for this episode, the Locked On Celtics Podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Get some tacos!
Taco time.
Yeah, J. King and John Corrales. Locked On Celtics. Millie's.